Okay, if everyone can find a seat, we will get started with our two friends. You guys are friends?
Mostly.
Yes. Mostly, okay. We have been known to be. Yes. Ever since prison.
You're editing the video.
Which one was the guard? You have some waters? I'll get a couple and set them out.
Thanks.
Here.
That's great.
I'll get one. Prison, you guys are used to sharing. Go ahead.
Thanks.
So my name is Mick Kirsten. I'm here with Dave West, and we're going to talk about this sort of journey that where we've had some convergent ideas over the past few years on what's happening around developers and how they've shifted the ALM landscape. So I'll just give you a quick intro of myself, then hand it over to Dave. And where I started from all of this was just through open source. I did my PhD thesis north of here in Vancouver at UBC on how to make the day more sane for developers by basically indexing and organizing and managing the whole day around these things we call tasks or work items, just these units of work. Because previously, I'd spent the previous 10 years of my career working on the more architectural programming side of things. And you know, some of you might find yourself in a similar situation. You've been an enterprise architect, and now you've been tasked with figuring out this ALM thing because it's turning out to be the bottleneck in your software delivery process. So we ran a series of experiments on Eclipse, both through the thesis, through the course of the thesis, where we actually made an abstraction for work items and embedded into the IDE. So very similar to what you're familiar with now in Visual Studio and the way it handles work items. But in this world of Eclipse, we had a lot of heterogeneity. You know, it was Track and Mantis, then Bugzilla, then Jira came along, and we had to make this unified framework. And the company became this experiment to see what would happen if we brought that to the server, because we were being asked not only to federate the data for developers and give them a unified notion of the task or the work item, but to connect other people in the software lifecycle. People talking about requirements that would then get implemented as epics and broken down into user stories and then needed feedback to roll back. Because in the world of open source and Eclipse, we had this one large work item engine. It was the Eclipse Bugzilla. In the world that you're dealing with, you probably have more than one, even if you're doing everything you can to consolidate onto TFS. So in this talk, we'll go over why there's been this force from developers, you know, driven through the IDE, driven through developers' tools, through these lightweight issue trackers and this much more lightweight way of working, and how that's changed ALM. Dave will present that, and I'll show you how you can connect up the more orchestrated the world of ALM and join it with these sort of lighter weight tools, with this heterogeneity that you might have if you're building on multiple platforms, and link it up into this one end-to-end flow where you get the best of both worlds, both the high-level orchestration and the tools that make developers happy and productive. Dave, what do you do?
Oh, so, hi. Good morning, everyone.
Oh, and I'm the CEO of Tasktop Technologies, and Dave, the Chief Product Officer. That's what he does.
Yeah, that's kind of what I do. So my name is Dave West. My mission in life, my personal mission, is to help people deliver software just a little bit better. It used to be to help people deliver software a lot better, and then I met the people and realized that it's actually damned hard, isn't it? Herding cats, as they say. So that has meant that I've done a few things in life. I must admit, and I'm going to have to say this in... that my name is Dave West, and I was a former product manager and owner of something called the Rational Unified Process in the UML. I do apologize if anybody finds that painful every day. Yes, I did create that. Then I went to work for a mad Swede called Ivar Jakobsen, and then I was an analyst at Forrester Research covering ALM, agile methods, etc. And then last April, I joined, I thought it was a company. It turns out it's a startup, which resembles a company, apart from it's a little bit more chaotic and you're not sure quite what you're doing on most days. And I run product at this company, which is an incredible opportunity to hopefully change the world. So the company, briefly, is all about connecting the world of software delivery, which connects nicely with the vision and the missions of both Mick and myself. Mick was all about enabling people to do things in a more productive way, and he created something called Mylin that's downloaded about 2 million times a month, which is part of the Eclipse framework now. Myself, I developed a few processes and wrote a few books on how to build software a little bit better, and it's all sort of come together at Tasktop. So the stuff we're going to be talking about today, or the experiment, if we're going to be lean startup, apparently if you put lean startup on anything now, you can sell it. So the experiment that we're doing today is really, in the presentation, is based on some work that I did when I was at Forrester with Jeffrey Hammond, another analyst there, and then recently wrote an article for SD Times about this thing called what I was describing as dev popularism, and this changing trend that we're seeing in the industry. In fact, I'm not the only person writing about it. There's, you know, O'Grady there, who's I always want to say little old lady O'Grady. Don't know why, but he wrote a book recently that was published by my friends at O'Reilly called "The New Kingmakers" and how developers are conquering and changing the world, and how developers are the most important commodity. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about that when we set up the scene and try to set some context to this thing called dev popularism today. So, as you may have noticed, I have a strange accent. I'm British, but I live in Boston, part of the car and all that. So, go Patriots. I'm not 100% certain. Surely the Patriots are all about England, aren't they? Anyway, it doesn't matter. But I used to be an analyst, and I can be a bit of a methodologist at times. That's also an insult, I know. So if I use words or phrases you don't understand, please feel free to stop us. And hopefully we'll have some fun as we go through these slides. So we try to answer a very simple question. Really, we're seeing this trend in the industry, and I'll explain what the trend is in a moment. What does it mean to the practice of application lifecycle management? What does it mean to the day-to-day practice in your businesses? What does dev popularism really mean? And how do we take advantage of it to help us build software faster that's of higher value to our customers? And that's really what these slides are going to be talking about. Let's set the scene. So we all know this Anderson's comment, software is eating the world. It's a really interesting, this was some data that we put together. It's an interesting trend. So this is a measure of volume on number of apps. You could have measured it in terms of lines of code. You could have measured it, I don't know, number of web pages. You could have measured it in all sorts of different ways. But ultimately, what we're seeing across the entire globe is that the number of the sheer volume of stuff, of software, is increasing at this sort of almost exponential rate. It's increasing massively. But the numbers of software engineers, professional people that build software every day, people that go to Star Trek conventions, don't go on dates, you know, the people like me and you aren't growing, other than maybe our stomachs, but aren't growing in the same rate. Now, obviously, we dealt with that with opening markets like India and now China, South Asia. Interesting piece of data, Eclipse is downloaded now more in Vietnam than it is in Germany. Android development, particularly, is driving this phenomenon. But the point is, so we're opening up new markets of engineering talent, but ultimately that can't grow at the same speed of the volume that we're seeing in terms of the lines of code, which is an interesting point, because what does that instantly make you think? Money. That's what it obviously made me think. Obviously, if you know your children, don't allow them to go out. Give them copies of, you know, Ruby or C Sharp, etc. Make them learn it, because then they'll be able to obviously keep you in the style you're accustomed to when you get old and you can't work yourself. So bottom line is that there's a great opportunity there in terms of getting paid. But also, interestingly, power. Because as a software engineer, you have an incredible amount of mobility. You also have an incredible amount of, you know, value to organizations. So that changes the dynamic. It changes, you know, it's like, remember the days, you know, 5, 6 years ago when investment banking was cool? Well, they had a lot of power. They could move around and exert that power. And they changed the way in which the business was done because of their ultimate power. So that's changing the dynamic in organizations. These are a bunch of developers you may have known. You know, these are the people that run a company called Facebook. Now, you might say, well, Facebook's not been a success. Ask their bank managers whether it's been a success. You know, these guys, and in fact, if you're ever bored on a Sunday evening, maybe it's raining, not that it ever rains in Seattle, but it may be raining, do Insider. Go onto Yahoo Finance and look at Insiders for Facebook, and you see, you know, somebody just $300 million quick Insider transaction. It always cheers me up. or not. But these people are developers, or a lot of them are. Actually, three of those are real developers, and they've changed the way in which we even think about our friends. You know, you check out people on Facebook more than you do in the real world. They've changed the reality and made development cool, and we're seeing that at Google and other companies. There's also this other trend, and it's called bring your own device, and called tech popularism, where we've got engineers, we've got normal human beings, actually non-engineers, bringing in their machines from home and starting to use it in the office. Isn't it embarrassing when your version of Windows at home is higher than your version of Windows in the office? That's kind of an embarrassing phenomenon. But ultimately, it means that we're seeing this fusion between the sort of home life and the technology that we use to drive, to buy bus tickets to, I don't know if people buy bus tickets anymore, but buy bus tickets or plane tickets or any of those things into the working world. And developers is happening as well. Another interesting data point, I don't know if you've read Dan Pink's book. I know that going to a conference, you always leave with a big list of books, don't you? I always thought it'd be nice to have a book club every evening at a conference to sort of, so you don't have to read these books. Somebody can just tell you about them. That would be far better. But this is another book to add to your amazing list of... Okay. We'll have a book club, and we're doing knitting, I see, out there. So I thought book clubs and knitting, that would be really good. I am turning into my grandmother. That's, if only I had her legs. Anyway, but the point, what's interesting about this book by Dan Pink, in fact, you don't need to read the book. Just go onto the TED Talk. It's 18 minutes. That's all you need to know. Having written a lot of books, you realize quite quickly that you have like five things to say. You can do that in about 3,000 words, and then you have to pad it. So, but then that's true of most books. But this is a good book. But look at the TED Talk. Well, he talks about three things: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. One thing that's really interesting is he did these investigations, he did this research into these organizations like Intuit, like Atlassian, and companies like that were really good at doing work, delivering software or doing business or whatever. And he found autonomy, mastery, and purpose were the three things that stood out. And what was interesting about these three things was that the organizations that had them, that allowed their people to have them, were incredibly more productive than organizations that didn't. And autonomy is an interesting point. Autonomy meaning that they can choose how they work. And isn't it interesting that we often hire people? I love the services business. It's a really interesting business. You have a client that knows nothing about building software. They go and they get a bunch of organizations, systems integrators, to build software for them. And then they tell them how to build software. And then obviously the system integrator doesn't deliver that software effectively and is blaming the client and saying, look, this isn't the way, all this stuff doesn't help us to build software. And they said, well, no, this is how you have to do it. It's called work products. It's called deliverables, which is always interesting. The point is that you're hiring people for the skills that they have and the ability to make choices, and they're empowered, and then they will be more productive. Because ultimately, innovation is incredibly important, and developers is where, if you believe Facebook and you believe Google, is where a lot of innovation in businesses is happening today. The ability to connect customers to opportunities, the ability to deliver services in a unique and special way requires innovation, and that is what developers provide you with. That is what engineers provide them with. So let's not constrain them, let's free them. But there's another perspective. So we have this story where developers are incredibly empowered. There's not going to be as many of them as we need. There's a lot of innovation, a lot of opportunity. But as software becomes more important, then guess what? The business starts being interested in it. Suddenly the CEO is interested in actually whether their app is on the marketplace. Hey, my daughter looked on the marketplace yesterday and the app wasn't there. Suddenly, everybody's interested when projects are late. In fact, when Tony Blair in the UK took the position of Prime Minister, it's a number of years ago, he stood for this idea of transforming the way in which income tax and other things were going to be delivered to the citizens, citizen England. It was a very different citizen-centric government he was talking about. And so he went to the software delivery organization, the civil service, and said, I want to do this. And they said, ooh, that's going to be about 25 years' work, that, mate. So he suddenly backed down quite quickly. But it's becoming important to the business. Therefore, the business is starting to take note. Therefore, it's not in the back room with a bunch of strange geezers. Suddenly, software is very important. That's what leads to things like ALM. ALM is the application of business management to the practice of software delivery. So it's really the fusion of the disciplines of requirements, development, testing, etc., into one integrated business process. Software development is a key business process, and it hasn't been engineered. It's evolved. It's got some great practices like Scrum, like feature-driven development, like, you know, even some of this idea of, you know, lean can be applied to it, but it hasn't been thought of as a process. So the key thing is really that you have to start thinking about software delivery as a process. But then you've got these pesky software engineers. This is a great Dilbert. I thought it was very appropriate that, you know, everything's in a Dilbert. Your entire life can be defined by Dilbert. That's a worrying thing, isn't it, really? But what he's talking about here is the fact that you've got these pesky engineers that get in the way of actually being successful, because the managers go, it's a key business process. We need to get some control over it, improve visibility of it, and we push that down to the engineers, and the engineers say, ah, well, sorry, guys, I don't know. It's going to really get in the way of us actually delivering software, so we're going to carry on doing it the way we've already done it. And then we have this perspective, you know? So everybody perceives everybody else in their own unique way. Developers see project managers as lazy golf players. Project managers see developers as resources to be delivered on. So there's an interesting contradiction there. So we've got empowered engineers that are being perceived in a different way. We've got managers now that think that software delivery is a key business process that we need to start managing effectively because the CEO is interested in it. And we have that disconnect. So I'd recommend that you think about three things. You think about federation, flow, and transparency. These three things are what modern ALM really needs to concentrate on. And I think that Sam's going to talk a little bit about this later as well. We need to think about, obviously, Star Trek analogy there, the federation, great. We need to think about the flow, the overall connection, the integration of all of this information into one data model, one understanding of the system. If it's a key business process, you have to think about federating all the different information that you have into one integrated view of the truth. There has to be one definition of the truth, and it can't be in spreadsheets. You know, the amount of organized, I don't know if you've had it yourself, but you're developing great software, you've got a separate test organization, you hand it over to testers, they then fill in a spreadsheet, send it back to you, you spend the first 20 minutes of every meeting arguing about whether that's the right version of the spreadsheet. And then you argue about what's in the spreadsheet, then you're always the spreadsheet's slightly out of date, and then there's always a discussion whether that really is, and then you start work on it, and then they send you another spreadsheet before you've actually finished the work on it. You're like, is that the real spreadsheet? We can't have that anymore. We need to federate this to have one definition of the truth. But to do that's hard. We're going to demonstrate some of it today in our keynote, but to do that's really, really hard. Integration isn't easy, and in fact, this was a survey that actually compelled me to join TaskTop. It was interesting. We did this survey, and I was expecting everybody to say, the reason why ALM isn't working in our organization is because of cost. Everybody's always cheap. You know, that's just the way everybody is today. And it was integration was the biggest problem. So it's a major roadblock. So to get this federation is actually pretty tricky. Then we have flow. So if federation or getting one message of the truth is really, really important to modern ALM in this dev populist world, then another thing is flow. This is Foxton Locks, which is just outside my hometown in England. It's the largest lock system in Europe, which is like there's probably five locks or something, but that's not the point. And it's all about flow. So if you think about modern ALM has to be about moving information and moving process, flowing it in a lean way across this whole life cycle, you need to think about it in this way. It means you have to connect up these different groups into an integrated way. So one definition of the truth coupled with one sort of overarching understanding of flow as the system works through it. And you start thinking about things like batch sizing. And you start managing complexity in a different way. One thing that Agile and Lean gives us is it increases the number of feedback loops and the frequency of those feedback loops. Now, as soon as you start doing that, that means your flow is definitely, if you're using a waterfall model, which most organizations, Water Scrum Full is the majority of process in the world, are doing, you're going to have to go back up the process flow to connect these different groups. It's an interesting problem, but flow is increasingly important when you're trying to take advantage of this overall ALM. Flow is and batch size is a really important idea, and you need to start thinking a little bit about it. And that's not just for software, it's also for operations. DevOps is a key concept and a key idea, or ops dev if you work in a different department. You try to think about how these organizations can fit together and think about that end-to-end flow as you try to get customer information back into your process, and you have to instrument and build the experiments to illustrate that. Unfortunately, though, flow is really, really tricky. Flow is really hard because you've got these disconnected systems. You don't have one definition of the truth. We've talked about that. You also don't have one ultimate flow. There's a lot of manual processes, a lot of handoffs, a lot of spreadsheets whizzing around. It makes it pretty tricky. This is a real data. This is a real architecture of a real customer that I snapped with my little phone. And when flow breaks down, waste increases and value reduces. Ultimately, that's what Lean teaches us, and that's the problem. So flow, so in this modern ALM world, we need to think about federation, so connecting all the data, one definition of the truth. We need to think about flow, and we need to think about, lastly, transparency. Transparency is crucial for this to work. Collaboration across these organizations is key, and collaboration needs to be enabled and facilitated in the best and possible way. Now, most organizations aren't in one location. You know, so you're going to have to think about how you can engage people, whether that's with Skype, whether that's with a Google Hangouts, whether that's with... You've got to keep that collaboration way, and you need a vehicle or a currency for that collaboration to enable that. Now, maybe if you're using TFS, that's the work item. Maybe the work item can become and can you can knit the work item in, connecting it into SharePoint, connecting it into discussion threads, connecting it into even copies of a Skype discussion. Because when you start getting that transparency, when you start getting everything to fit together, you can start visualizing the process and start understanding it. You can start understanding the flow. When you get that information all put together, you can start enabling everybody to work together. Now, those three concepts are incredibly important to enable these very strong engineering types, these software engineers, to be freed in the context of ALM. And in fact, I'm going to hand over to Mick, who's going to demonstrate how you can kind of do that. Mick.
Thanks, Dave. So I think there was a very interesting talk earlier this week which examined connecting TFS to as part of the ALM stack that's become quite heterogeneous. So we've had this some proliferation of open source SCM systems that have been proven out in terms of their workflow model, first CVS, then Subversion, most recently Git, because they captured something about developer workflow that the system before them didn't. In the case of Git, it was Linus Torvalds' need to have this ability to, just a better mechanism for doing reviews, staging code reviews, and distributing this kind of work in a very highly distributed open source environment. And Git was that system. It's horrendously complex compared to most commercial SCM systems, but it captured something about developers. It's made by developers for developers. The controls was inverted, and it caught fire. So on Eclipse, I'm a member of the Eclipse Board of Directors and Planning Council, we switched off Subversion and CVS in December. So all of Eclipse, those 60 million lines of code, are now done in Git. And there are all sorts of pains about managing Git in enterprise scale, using things like Garrett and the fact that it's lacking all those enterprise features that you're used to, like proper integration with access control. Yet it's making it into our organizations right now. And if you're deploying it, it's going to be causing you some pains in the process. It's going to make a bunch of your developers happy. It's going to make developers who expect a commit to cause code to be to show up in trunk or master, very confused when they have to learn how pushing works. What we saw earlier with the Git integration for TFS is the marriage of these two worlds, right? Where in a similar way to how TFS can speak the Subversion protocol or the Exchange server can speak POP or IMAP, the TFS SCM is now speaking the Git protocol. And so you're getting this best of both worlds. And this is pretty important because even if, let's say, you're standardizing on TFS, you will have teams who have independently selected Git. And you know, there'll be a lot of the sort of Ruby development, a lot of the new client languages and platforms have this affinity to these new ALM platforms and tools. So they're just creeping or their way into your organization. And you're not getting any of the benefits of this sort of orchestration and end-to-end visibility of TFS if you've got these pockets and they're completely disconnected. So again, this works for that team who's making, say, a mobile client in Ruby or an iOS app. But there's this other problem that in the sense that they're probably using a different issue tracker. So we've got a lot of our organizations, even though we're trying to standardize on an enterprise-grade ALM tool, we have Jira all over the place. There'll be open source issue trackers over the place, Ruby developers like Redmine. So connecting up to really get this best of both worlds view on the ALM functionality that the organization needs, speaking to some of the points that Dave mentioned, and connecting that up to what developers are pushing into the organization because they're becoming decision makers in selecting some of the tools. So also, our organizations have acquisitions. There'll be choices made previously that you're stuck with, like the fact that the company that you acquired to create your mobile front end is using a tool like Jira and Git. You now have to fold that into a more orchestrated process, and not only at the SCM level, but also at this issue tracking level. Because in the end, I think Dave alluded to this, we do think of, in terms of connecting this flow and collaboration end to end, work items become this currency of collaboration. They're what everything gets hooked into, that they're how you can translate business value up and get feedback right from the customer. So, and that was this whole experimentation that we did around the Milan project to prove that out. So the problem is, basically, you have to connect that issue tracker up so that all of those features that you have in TFS work for the defects and work items and issues, whatever else, that are in these other systems, that are part of either your Compass application, or potentially they're part of your supply chain. If you have a software supplier who's using Jira, or a testing supplier who's using Quality Center, you want that stuff to show up in these dashboards, because now you've got the centralized view, this very nice hub, but if those other parts of your system are invisible to it, you're not getting all that value. So the picture that we most often see with these large-scale TFS deployments is that you want to consolidate as much as possible into TFS. You now have a mechanism from the integration framework for getting Subversion and Git interoperability out of the box. And your problem is that you've got this myriad of other tools, these other issue trackers, that have proliferated much, much more than the SCM tools have. I remember, Dave, at one point when we were chatting, you mentioned that there was, at one point, a Forrester survey that asked what issue tracker do you use, and there were 100 possible responses. So those are some of the most common ones that we see, but there's this very long tail of them. And some of them are tailored to particular parts of the lifecycle as well. Some of them are better for working on some kind of platforms, just like TFS is great for connecting up to the Azure and .NET technologies. In Java, because there's so much fragmentation in Java, there's just a ton of proliferation of these tools. So what we really want to give you is this unified view on it. Whether you're the developers in Visual Studio, or you're sitting and staring at looking at the burndown chart in the browser, that through this, you basically, through that TFS lens and all the reports, everything built on that work item tracking engine and the SCM engine, is now visible for these more complex applications. So I'll show you, the approach, and what we think this means is interoperability and integration. So we need to solve this. The way to solve this is not by telling everyone to move to one tool tomorrow, because that's what's been hard. And that's where, again, the bottom-up pull of developers and that resistance has made it impossible for a lot of organizations to just do that. So again, to connect the best of both worlds, the lifecycle management, all that functioning in TFS, with a tool like Jira, which developers love, but they love it because it's the opposite of what Dave built a long time ago with RUP, right? It has no management functionality, which means you get very little traceability. And if you've got a large organization, it's just not suitable for enterprise scale development for managing that. It's suitable for making developers happy because there's not much overhead in entering issues and collaborating on them. So I'll just show you an example of how we approach this right now. Here we are in a black screen. There we go. And let's say we're in TFS. And again, you've rolled a TFS, you've got an issue over here, and you're now wanting to connect that TFS lens to other parts of your ecosystem. Our whole view on the way lifecycle integration needs to happen is that this information, it's everything they've said. You need to have that empowerment, which means you allow some group to use a specialized issue tracker. But you need that information flow in real time as well. And the interesting thing is that in looking at this, we're finding these common models of work items across these tools. So the demonstration I'll give you here, you know, the concepts are general. This is the tool that we created for this purpose. We'll give you a sense for how you can think about connecting up your ALM stack to TFS if you have one of these heterogeneous stacks. So this is the sync tool. It just sits in the background. I'll show you the administrative console, how we can connect to two different issue trackers. So let's just say that we've got Team Foundation server and the tool, you know, this is connected now to everything on my VM. It's connected to tools on your network. And you've got teams using Jira. And often we'll actually encounter organizations that have 10 Jira servers because Jira tends to max out at 200,000 issues. So you've got this TFS instance and multiple Jira instances or other tools in the mix as well. So we're just going to connect to those repositories. I've already entered the credentials before this. There's been no setup otherwise. And it's now connected to the data models of both tools and downloaded all the schemas, so it knows the projects. And it just needs to be pointed at an issue ID so it can start looking at attributes of those projects. So it's going to do that right now and talk to TFS. And then same with Jira. So I'm just going to put two issue IDs to get the tool bootstrap connecting and talking to these systems. So that's it. These two tools, their bug artifacts are now linked in real time. So from now on, if a developer is working in Jira over here, and they, let's refresh this. We see that this issue actually just got renamed because I've been playing with the different names. If they save this in real time, which for us is under a second, that change shows up inside TFS. So TFS is loading over here. I'll go make the change over here in TFS now, save it, refresh it in Jira, and these work items and their data models are linked. So we see it over here. I'll go make a concurrent change, so I'll change this to 3. And you can change any field, obviously. So I'll change it to 3. Why can't I change it? There we go. Let's make it 4, and I'll change it in TFS right now to be 5s without refreshing, which is a problem. And now, of course, there's a conflict. So what's happened is that with TFS as your main work item engine, the Jira team doing the mobile client and messing up the OAuth stuff you set up just now has a view onto those TFS work items, but all the data is stored in both systems. Because what we've done behind the scenes, or what the admin's done behind the scenes, is set up the sync server, which sees all of the schemas of all the tools that it's connected to. You can browse them over here, and they're updated live. And you just make these mappings. So the summaries have been mapped by default for me with this wizard. Well, I can map things like priority values. And of course, they map bidirectionally. And then I need to cast them, because these tools speak very similar languages, but the concepts are not quite the same. Jira, by default, in the default templates, they don't have the same number of priority values. So, and this is part of the problem, right? Dave mentioned collaborating with spreadsheets. We had this very interesting experience when we were working with another team in China whose notion of priority values, they thought P4s were highest. And we thought P1s were highest. And this caused an amazing amount of problems until we realized it. And then everything was fine. So the bottom line is we need an infrastructure, we need an automation for connecting these tools to get the most value of tools like TFS. We need to know, of course, the tool knows that it's missing a mapping over here. And then we can say that, you know, this is a P4 as well, and save this, and then have things be happy. So what we're basically doing is trying to take that flow that they've talked about and connect all these tools up, again, in real time, so that you're seeing all the data flowing from TFS according to these mappings, which often be around projects, around teams, but really around these artifacts. Because what we've got here is just this bus. The bus gives you this when, you know, similar to an ESB, a bus is needed for the lifecycle in order to get that data into whatever you've selected as your ALM hub, into whatever you're seeing your burndowns and your reports in, and everything else. So that you've got, whether for whatever reason you end up with that heterogeneity, you've got that lens, you've got that that information flowing. And what's really important is you've got that collaboration. Those Jira developers are not sending you a spreadsheet. They're just hitting close on the issue. That comment shows up immediately in TFS, and your burn down is up to date for that part of your application or for that application. So our whole goal here is just to connect, you know, to look at what these common artifacts are, because it's always across these silos, and whether the silos are within your large organizations because the business analysts chose their own tool, which, you know, they had some storyboarding thing that they liked in it, or because testers are so heavily invested in Quality Center, or because you've got a part of your application that's Java and it's using another issue tracker, those artifacts are common across those tools. And those green arrows, we call them, we still argue about what we call them, but we tend to call them tasks because they represent units of work. And they're basically things that you can express as work items in TFS. They show up. Sometimes they're higher level, sometimes they're requirements. Requirements can have specifications. They have these interesting contexts. But the interesting thing is that we're able to hook up for all our customers, these tend to be sort of large development organizations, in real time all of their systems and have this data flowing for that mapping. And there's always some kind of mapping, because that you're already doing that anyway, and you're doing it with email and spreadsheets. It needs to turn to real time to really light up what's there in your ALM deployment, what's there, the features in TFS, to see all of your life cycle. So we've got this kind of a busy slide, but just in terms of the concepts that we look at this, in terms of do this kind of integration, there's the data level mapping is really key. So the fact that all of the data is mapped between these tools, and it gets a little interesting when you've got a tool like, if we look at TFS over here, it uses HTML formatting for comments, but another tool uses, like Jira, uses Wiki Markup, uses Confluence. So we have to have this full fidelity translation of the two, because as soon as you don't, developers will pull out of that system, they'll not be saving the stuff as work items, and they're back in email IM and, or, you know, insanely long status meetings where they talk about it instead of just commenting on it. So then we've got identity is important. There was a generation of these integration systems that did not preserve identity. If you've got to support this kind of real-time flow of information, that user in Jira has to show, when they comment, their comment has to show up as their name in TFS, or you're not supporting collaboration. Activity, the fact that all of these issue trackers and the ones that have been popular with developers, they all have an activity feed. Right? TFS has a first-class activity feed of comments, of commits, and so on. All of these tools have a first-class activity feed, and those have to be synchronized. You know, it's the situation for most large organizations, for all our customers, is, you know, it's as if between those silos that we see, you basically have tools that are as different as, you know, Google Plus and Facebook, except there's five of them. And you're commenting, and the comments are not showing up. Or Yammer, right? These tools, they're just completely disconnected. And so we have to synchronize activity feeds across the tools, or again, we're not keeping people in the tools. That data is not flowing at the TFS, where it can be reported on, where you've got the traceability, where you've got the linking to code, and so on. Process model has been an interesting one for us, because you actually have to, this is why this notion of synchronizing work items is so different than synchronizing just data, or synchronizing between REST APIs, because there's a process model underneath these things and a workflow model. So closing a defect in Jira and having it close in TFS means you actually have to execute both workflows. And you might have to reopen it if there's a plugin that's customizing it, which has been one of the really tricky things about doing integration. And again, but it has to be done. And we, as organizations, we actually have to look at our process model in terms of what we want on the developer side, what developers are asking for, and then tell them, no, you're going to have those five required fields, because we can't report on, you know, what project you're working on, what the billing code is, if you don't add those five required fields. And there's not been enough of this happening with this developer populism movement, because they've just been allowed to set up their Jira the way they want, or their Bugzilla, or whatever other issue tracker they have. So we have to look at this process model across this chain more and more. And then, yeah, there's this user interface level federation. We've got the Eclipse Mountain Desktop DevTools. They do it on the user interface, but I think our view right now is shifting into, let's just get all this data on the server into TFS, and then you've got this one window on it, whether it's the browser or the IDE, but it's all there to be reported on. So back to the concepts that Dave introduced, if you think of this end-to-end flow, and if you think of the way I visualize these things is usually as these task work item things. So not thinking of requirements as a specification of what should run in this model, more model-driven view of the world, but thinking of them as tasks that people collaborate on. So you know they want to create a new capacitive touch display for their device. You've basically got, as you're ramping up, you've got more and more requirements building up. And at some point in this world where you've got separate tools, you're handing those off to development. And they're picking them up, and they're making their user stories in whatever tool they're making those user stories in. And you're lucky if you're in a tool like TFS, because you actually get to do both of these things, whereas a lot of companies using other AM tools will actually have completely separate tools for that. It's handed off to testing somehow. And then you know things are closed, and the quality goes up, and then we've got this other sort of ongoing set of operations. And the height of those shapes is basically how many, let's say, how many open work items there are at that stage in the cycle. So you know the operations were continuing to get that feedback from customers and so on, from failures in the field. And in this world where we've got these separate tools, that basically the task batch sizes get very, very large. As soon as they're not, we don't have this kind of real-time communication and flow, and it gets worse in development because they get completely isolated to what's happening on requirements, and there's no feedback back. So if the development team finds out that you know the mobile SDK you chose isn't, the performance of it is just not going to work for this application, you might not find that out, or the people, the business analysts might not find out till way too late because they're completely disconnected from the conversation. And from the status of what's happening in a developer tool. And to really get these concepts of lean, we need to just reduce those task batch sizes. And the only way to reduce those task batch sizes is to get these tools connected in real time where the collaboration can flow. So if you find something out partway through this process, you're discovering development, it feeds back into requirements. You're getting you know, things that are votes or likes on a particular part of your app or a feature of your app are actually making it back into the requirements discussion as well. And you know, the way that we see flowing that information is through a work item engine that's expressive enough to bring to move those things back and forward across this, across the life cycle. And that's exactly what we're trying to do into TFS, to connect all those artifacts with some fields that you might add or some new work item types that you might define so that you can get those small batch sizes. So what does this all mean?
Yeah, so what does all this mean? So ultimately, we're now trying to treat software delivery as a key business process in the same way as other business processes, your CRM and customer management and inventory management and all those other processes are. You've got some amazing tools with TFS. It, you know, it's a bit like the SAP of software development for without all the bad things, obviously. Sorry about that.
It's better.
It's better than SAP. But to enable that process. Unfortunately, you end up in this world which is disconnected. You end up in this world which is federated. And as developers become more powerful, they are going to continue to bring in things from home that they're working on, or mechanisms or techniques that they've seen in a book, or they've met some crazy bald guy at a conference, because we all are, and they want to get, you know, want to start using this technology. Ultimately, if you don't glue that into your process in an effective way, if you don't connect this flow, if you don't enable transparency and you don't enable federation, you're going to end up with a process that's broken, and you'll never get that leanness that you all aspire to adopt. So I think ultimately it's about balancing, really. You know, you could just adopt one tool and say everybody log on and type that information into one tool. The likelihood of it being up to date is very low. You could send a spreadsheet around and enable people to work together in a spreadsheet. You could put a big whiteboard on the wall with post-it notes. That's a very effective way, but it doesn't necessarily scale. What you have to think about is doing a process that makes the most sense for you. So it's all about balance. It's about balancing ALM as a dictatorial, sort of like totalitarian sort of process, with the freedom and flexibility of the Wild West in some sort of balanced way. Process ownership, visibility, standards, skills are important things to sort of decide in your organization. One thing that we've observed, which is really interesting, when you start connecting up the process, when you start adopting ALM in an enterprise at large, is you start getting a lot of interesting insights into the disconnects between these groups. A great example is the testers and the developers, the defect priority. In fact, that particular story that Mick told, it was 10 p.m., because, of course, China's in a different time zone. My office is next to our bedroom, and my wife was sitting there, and all she said she heard was me going, I've written books on software development. I know what a business, what a high-level defect is in the middle of the night. And I got really, really grumpy, and then she heard me banging downstairs, and she heard the drinks cabinet being opened and a large whiskey being consumed. She said, and then when I got into bed, she goes, how was that? I said, oh, it was fine, love. No problem at all. It was good. She goes, you've written some books on software development, I hear. So, and they said, yeah, and they completely ignored me on that. But it's interesting, those discussions between those two groups, those trying to get agreement around how, you know, what a defect states are, what's important. Also starting to, you get some ideas on batch size. Great example is you connect to test with development and you realize that you're working in an agile way. So why are all the work, why is it only moving into test once every 4 weeks? Why isn't it continuously moving into test? Well, you know, we have to give them, we like it to be good before we give it to testers. Okay. So, you know, there's lots of observations that you start to get, and you start managing that balance, and you start deciding how flexible you are going to be with respect to popularism and how controlled you're going to be in regard to process. Because ultimately, you're trying to make everything flow together. I would argue, ladies and gentlemen, that the only way in the 21st century to effectively do software delivery at the speed that you need to do to deliver ultimate value to your customers is by automating parts of it. Develop, test, deploy. It needs to be an automated process. It gets incredibly hard to do that when you've got all these disconnected process models, all these disconnected teams. You then need to build that into an overall lean process where define or think, as we've also call it, and review is part of that process. And then you end up with that end-to-end transparency and visibility to make the right decisions about the software that you're building. So what we tried to do today was show you what ALM potentially could mean to your organization as developers become more empowered and more in control of their own destiny. Developers are incredibly interesting characters, very peculiar in lots of ways, but incredibly passionate about what their craft. These people are bringing in new practices every day. You know, it was ever so funny when I was the product manager of the RUP. The RUP had become the de facto standard process in the industry. This was about 2002-ish. 2001. I remember it very well. And we got an email from Alistair Coburn, and he said, Dave, we're having this thing in Utah. You may have heard of it. We're going to do this agile thing. And I can remember Grady Booch and I having a conversation about it, and Grady goes, it's only those damn developers. What do they know about software development? How wrong we were, hey? Anyway, so developers are changing the way in which software is built every day. You need to work with them, enable them, facilitate that change, take advantage of it, but connect it into the process that is software delivery. It's a key business process to your business. So if you're a practitioner, what are you going to do? You've got to take ownership of your toolkit. Use the tools that make sense to you to do your job. Concentrate on murder, on waste. Get rid of that waste in your organization. Pick tools. Automate processes. Don't be frustrated. You know, break out of the things that are really getting in the way of you being effective. And take advantage of all that great stuff that's on the market today that's either in the open source community or small vendors or Microsoft or whatever. But use the tools that make sense. But think about how that tool fits into this overall flow. Think about how you can federate that information. Think about how you can make the information that's in it that's transparent to everybody else. You know, you've got to be a good citizen, a manager. You've got to embrace and free your developers. You've got to allow them to be who they need to be to deliver value. You can't, on one hand, it's sort of like hurry up and wait. You know, on one hand you're saying, why are you late? On the other hand you're saying, well, no, you can't do that. You can't use the carrot and the stick in parallel. You need to free them. Just get the carrot out. But accept that you're going to have to connect them into a broader ecosystem of ALM, this end-to-end process. If you want to start practicing sort of like scaled agile or any of the frameworks around lean or even lean startup from Eric, what you need to do is feed that information back, and that requires them to automate those processes, to connect them into a broader ALM story with TFS as that system of record for your business. If you can't connect it into TFS, maybe we need to think about how we can do something else. And tool vendors. So there's a number of tool vendors in the audience, some of them Microsoft, some of them others. You know, you're going to have to accept, particularly with mobile, but also with cloud, that we're hitting an age where there's incredibly complex software ecosystems. And heterogeneity is the norm. Who'd have thought you'd have seen Microsoft demoing Git? Who'd have thought that? I saw V as well, you know. That took me back, STSTY, you know, backspace ampersand. They were the days, weren't they, when, you know, software developers were software developers, but as opposed to something else. But who'd have thought that, hey? Who'd have thought that you would see these, you know, that it's on a stage, you would see, you know, Git that was developed for the Unix community, Git that's all about distributed development, that's all about, you know, sort of open source development, allowing people to go off and never come back, which is an interesting way of, you know, of forking your code. And then tool vendors think about standards. Think about providing a rich API like Microsoft has done, which allows integration with tools like TaskTop Sync. That's the world that we live in today. We're going to have to connect these systems of record to enable this end-to-end business process that is ALM. ALM is the business process of software delivery. That's what we're going to be automating. That's what we're going to be making faster, more efficient. That's what we're going to be applying lean to. So that's really what we wanted to talk about today, I think. Hopefully, it's been a little bit interesting. You saw a bit of Jira just to add to your Git. That's always cool, isn't it? You'll have lots of developer street cred when you leave this room. If you want, there's lots of materials there. Obviously, follow us. That's always fun. And you hear about all sorts of exciting happenings in my life, which is perhaps a little embarrassing. So I think we have time for a few questions, if anybody's got any questions around heterogeneity, around dev popularism, around, I don't know, who's going to win the Super Bowl.
And I've got a mic up here, if anybody wants to raise your hand. They've been very shy with hands this year.
I know. I think it may be the open bar. You know that you should never let an Englishman into an open bar?
We should stop recording right now.
Yes. It's all sorts of trouble. So obviously last night you're probably feeling a little tired, a little jaded.
No, they didn't raise their hands before you came either.
My fault, is it? I accept that.
Anything?
No questions, no comments? You're looking a bit tired?
No, I think they're just digesting what you said.
Oh, just before they digest.
Questions will come up in 10 minutes once we break.
Cool. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for your attention.
Guys.
Have a great conference.
Okay, well, let's break for lunch, and let's see. We have a breakout after lunch, and then we have the lightnings, and then we have our last two sessions.